This is David Moore, recorded at his home in Radlett, Hertfordshire, by Felicity Aston on the 26th of October 2010.
My name is David Moore, David Peter Moore, and I was born on the 30th of August 1934, and that makes me 76 years old now. And I was born at Lee-on-Sea in Essex.
So, David, what was your first job out of school?
I was an office boy working for Shell Tankers. We used to collect all the logbooks from the Shell Tankers and work out how much fuel they'd used and what sort of mileage they'd done all around the world and various things like that.
And then you did your national service with the Royal Air Force, and was that where you got your experience as a wireless operator?
Yes, national service started for me on November the 11th, 1952, and I did all the usual square bashing, and then went to a trade school down at Compton Bassett, RAF Compton Bassett, where I learned Morse, because they battered us with Morse day after day, until we spoke in Morse virtually, and we did it every evening. And people were tapping out Morse all day until it nearly sent you mad. But we all got used to using Morse regularly, and you know, it became a second language to us. And I was picked then to go with six others to Germany. And I finished up in a small unit at RAF Hamburen near Celle in Germany, in Western Germany then, and we were monitoring Russian and East German units, both the Air Force and the Army, just for any details that they might let slip, and we passed them all back to Cheltenham. And I won't say any more, because I'm probably breaking the Official Secrets Act now. But so it's a long time ago.
Was becoming a wireless operator following your own interest, or was this something that you were just allocated to do? And
I was told to put my hand up when I heard a trade that interested me, and I did that because I'd worked in an office. I stuck up my hand when they said office jobs, and they said, there are no office jobs left, you will have to take a test for doing wireless operating. So I said, all right, fair enough. And that was that. So I became a wireless operator. The usual service thing that if you wanted to be a cook, they sent you out fighting somebody and vice versa. So I did what I was told.
So how did you first hear about FIDS? Was this something you were aware of?
I knew nothing about it at all. When I'd finished the Royal Air Force, I went back to work for Shell Tankers and was then moved to Eagle Oil and Shipping, which is one of their smaller units for taking oil around the world. And by then I had met my future wife called Charlotte, and we used to travel backwards and forwards on the train from Lee-on-Sea to London to go to the office in the morning and home at night. And we had the Evening Standard, and used to look at that every night in the train going home, and she said, and because I'd been talking about going whaling or something ridiculous like that, she said, oh, here's a good job for you. I think she was probably trying to get rid of me, but anyway, she said that, why didn't you have a go at that if you're interested in, because I was fed up with working in an office. It was just ridiculous after working in the Air Force, which at least had a bit of fun with it, you know. They're all very somber and sober in the offices of Shell, and I thought I wanted to get away from that. And so I sent off a letter to this box number, I think it was. It may have been. It may have been Crown Agents. Lo and behold, I had an answer from them to say, come and see. And so I went to the Crown Agents office in London. Excuse me, my voice is going a bit. Went to the Crown Agents. And they told me a little bit about it, and they said, are you interested? And I said, well, that sounds very interesting, yes. And they said, what about your Morse? And so I produced my papers, on which were discharge papers, which said that I could use Morse at 25 words a minute, which was regarded as fairly good, you know, because I'd gone up to senior air craftsman by then, and you had to pass a test. So 25 words a minute, and they said, well, that's grand, you know, well, you'd better start. And I had a medical, and they found that I had some bronchial asthma, and they said, well, never mind, because you will be going to a static base, you know, going to a base, and you won't be moving very far, and if you do, you'll just have to make it not for not very long, because you're going to be a wireless operator. So I said, fine, okay, that's all right by me. And that was it. So a week later, I had a letter to say, you're going to be going to the Antarctic. And so I thought, oh, I've got to start reading about it. So I read one or two books at that point. And so it was fairly hard work, but who cares about hard work, you know. But
what was the response of your sort of friends and family to this when you announced that you were going to the Antarctic? Was it seen as quite a crazy thing to do, or dangerous and adventurous?
They thought it was, you know, it was all exciting to them, and they all were asking questions about it, which I couldn't really answer. But the local press got hold of it, the South End Standard, and came and interviewed me. They didn't listen to a word I said, as is typical of the press. and so they put, you know, did pieces in the local paper about me. And after that, strangely enough, another young man called at the door one day, Frank Ryan, who eventually went to Base Y on the same time as I did. He went down on the Shackleton at the same time as me. And we had a talk and so on and so forth. And we said we'd meet up on the Shackleton, which we did eventually. He was, you know, nice young man. I think he's actually died since then. I'm not really sure about that. I can't remember. But anyway, so eventually, on just before Christmas, we joined the Royal Research Ship Shackleton and set off. My mum came to see me off, and that was great.
Tell me a little bit about when you were getting ready, because there was a bit of a delay, wasn't there?
There was. I was just coming to that, yes. Well, we all got on the ship and off we sailed. You know, here we come to the Antarctic. But it was fairly rough out in the channel, and we got to Tor Bay. And there we stopped, put down the anchors, and that was that. And they said, we've got a problem. Well, the cargo is shifting, and we can't sail any further with it like this. We've got to go back to Southampton. So get ready, boys, for the journey back. We all went back to Southampton. Christmas was fast approaching, so they said, well, you'd all better go home, have another Christmas dinner, which we'd all had beforehand. Excuse me. So that was the second one. And so we reported back to the ship in Southampton on the 29th of December, and we set off again. And sure enough, there was no problems then. They'd got it all sorted out. So we sailed down to the Cape Verde Islands, and that was interesting because what they called the bumboats came out from the Cape Verde Islands and all trying to sell us fruit and all sorts of things. I forget what, and cigarettes and whatever. And So we got rid of all them and sailed on to Montevideo, and we passed the German battleship, which was alongside the River Plate, and I can't remember the name of that, but anyway, everybody knows it. And so we spent about 2 days, I think, in Montevideo, maybe three, which was quite an enjoyable and exciting time, as any old fiddler will tell you, and I'm not going to say any more.
What was the atmosphere while you were on? This was the first time you'd met your fellow feds.
It was all very quiet to start with, but we gradually got used to each other. And when we crossed the line, I forget who was running that, but one of the blokes ran it who'd crossed the line before, and the seamen as well, and the officers were all engaged with it. We had a jolly good time and all got not beaten up, but, you know, shoved around in the usual way. And by then we were all quite a cheerful crowd together, but never boisterous. You know, we weren't getting drunk every night or anything like that. It was a fairly quiet trip down, but full of good talk and full of comradeship, which is building up. You know, none of us knew very much about it. I think we were all new FIDs, so I don't think there was anybody there who knew what we were going into. There may have been one or two, and I may have listened, but I can't remember. We went into Montevideo, and out we came and headed for Port Stanley. I remember passing the Fitzroy, the old Fitzroy, on the way back from Port Stanley to Montevideo, which was its regular run. And we passed that one day and all did lots of waves as we passed by. We arrived in Port Stanley, I think, very early in... I think it was about the third week in January, but I'm not really sure about that. I could find it somewhere, but it was then. And so we docked in Port Stanley, and then a further round of collecting clothing and finding out a bit more what we were doing, what we were going to do. And I was told that I would be going to start a new base with seven others, pardon me, and that I would have to start a radio station, which filled me with horror, because I'd never done anything like that in my life before. I'd been listening and sending Morse, but I'd never sort of run a radio station and never dealt with the aerials or never dealt with anything really technical. They ticked boxes when I did the technical bits in the Air Force. They just said, "Oh, well, he knows about that," you know. And I didn't really know much about it, to be honest. And I said to them, "Well, look, you may be sending the wrong man down to start a new radio station." And they said, no, you'll be all right." And I remember going back to the Shackleton and saying to Jack Hill and Ken Hill, who both travelled down, we were all three of us wireless operators, so we got on quite well together. Ken had been in the Navy, Jack had been in the Air Force like me. And I said, "Look, lads, I know a good job for you down at Base W. You'll enjoy it." And they said, "Get on with it. You do it." So that was the end of that. Nobody was going to volunteer to take my place. So I thought, well, okay, I'm stuck with it. I'm going to have to do it. And I talked to Lofty Tyson, who had been down there as a radio operator, as a wireless operator. And he was running the repair shed in Stanley, you know, so he was in charge of radios. And so one day, I think, while we'd been in Stanley for a few days, I went back to the ship and they said, "Have you heard what's happened to your radio, your transmitter?" And they said, "It's been dropped," and it had been dropped about 30 feet down into the hold of the old John Biscoe, or somewhere anyway. So they'd taken it up to Lofty Tyson and said, "It's all broken, mend it." And he, poor chap, was, you know, very good at his job, and he mended it as far as he could. But it was chaos from there on, quite honestly, you know, because it gave me trouble for the whole year. I'm not telling a sob story, but that's what it was like. It was, you know, I had to make the best of it. Never mind, you know, we went south. I knew my other base members by that time, and felt very happy with them.
So you've met them in the Falkland Islands, have you, your base members, or had they sailed down with you?
I can't quite remember that, to be honest. I know one of them had, and that was Mike Orford, because he's on the ship. I've got a photograph of him on the Shackleton, but I haven't got a photograph of anybody else, and I don't remember anybody else. But there, you know, there was Tom Murphy, he was the base leader. There was Eric Salmon, who was our wise old judge, because he'd been on several trips down there. He'd been on Deception and been here, there and everywhere, and knew everybody and knew how to work dogs and knew how to cook. That was the first time I had met Eric. And I think he'd been in Port Stanley for some time, having come back the previous year from down south. So that was useful. And it was said, I was friends with his wife, actually, after he... Well, we stayed friends when I came back. And the poor chap had a serious heart attack or something. What do you call it when your left side gets paralysed? But anyway, he was aged just over 60. He'd just retired from FIDS. He was working for FIDS in Cambridge. And anyway, he had this severe attack, and I went up to see him a couple of times where he lived in Cambridge. And poor chap was struggling. You know, he had had a stroke, that's what it was. He was his old cheerful self, but he could be a bit twitchy, as it were, you know, difficult to get on with. But he's always friendly and happy. But sometimes he used to say terrible things about my wireless operating at that time. You know, this is well after. His wife, I was friends with her as well, because they'd married down in Port Stanley. That was to Frieda. Frieda Salmon, do you remember the name? No, she died a couple of years ago, actually. No, this last year. And so, but I went to Eric's funeral and did a speech or something. Anyway, so I knew him, and Frieda always maintained that he should have been the base leader, but he was, as she said, something of a maverick, which he was. that was his speciality. That's what made him so good. He was. But he and Tom got on extremely well, so that was no problem. They worked together. And there was Ron Miller, who was a brilliant builder and a mountaineer. And there was Hedley Wright, who played the bagpipes and regarded himself as above most people. Mike Orford, who died last year in South Africa. He was a surveyor. Who else? Oh, goodness. So I won't try and remember them. They'll come back to me in a minute.
So what about Tom Murphy? What did you make of him when you first met him? Was he reassuring as a base leader?
He was like a father figure. And quite confident about what he was doing. He was a Scotsman, a good man to have around. And I was only 21 at the time. You see, I mean, I was the youngster. As Ron Miller wrote to me in reply to one of my letters not so long ago, he said, "Nobody told me you were nobbit a lad." He comes from Barrow and Furness, which is what you tell. That was a perfect accent from Barrow and Furness. But so I was 21, and you know, and then but I had to sort of pretend that I was 31. Like most of them seemed to were obviously much older than me in my terms then. You know, anything from 24 to 25 up to 30 to 31, 32, something like that. Anyway, so I felt really at home with some blokes who knew what they were doing, even if they hadn't been down on base before. But Eric had Ray Cooper, another brilliant man. He was the diesel mechanic. He was ex-Navy, and he'd been on Deception Island. So he was that was Eric and Ray. Ray Cooper was one you could depend on in any circumstances. In fact, the whole lot of them were, really and truly. And they helped me immensely all the way through. Whenever I needed anything or a bit of nudging on, you know, they were there to do it. And without any fussing and bothering, we were like a big family. We quickly became I'm not sure that we became a family on the old John Biscoe, because we went down south on the old Biscoe, the old whaling ship. No, it was a minesweeper or something. It looked like a dinghy, but it was moored even behind the Shackleton, which wasn't big. So we all got onto the John Biscoe, and I've got a photograph of... Where is it now?
You've just mentioned to me that Wally Herbert was on the boat with you.
So yes, that's right.
Do you know much about Wally Herbert?
No. Yes and no. We had a quiet trip down. I remember him coming out with us. He was one of our group that got into some of the worst pubs in Montevideo, and we met all sorts of strange people in there, and we had a good laugh about that afterwards. And so, when, you know, on this journey, when we were into Port Stanley, no, I wasn't, you know, we sort of talked and we bumped into each other and had discussions about things, but we weren't close friends, but, you know, we knew each other as pals, you know, for a short-term period. Anybody who'd been in the services was easy to deal with that way, because you knew that you met somebody and then you moved on quickly, and you didn't make long-term friends, you know, you just made friends quickly and suddenly you were moved on, and you didn't have to worry about that. So that was the situation there. I know that we then sort of set off to the south, and we were very... Do you want to... This is going... This... it was exciting when we got closer to the ice. We started to see bits of ice and bits of whales and all sorts of Antarctic-type things like that, and it was quite exciting. And we started to call at different bases then, unloading into what we called a scow, which was a dirty big boat. And so we unloaded all sorts of stuff into them, took it ashore, unloaded it. It was sheer hard work, nothing else than that. It was just hard labour. But we did it because we were all young, and we could always have a nice meal back on the ship and have a few beers, and so we survived it all. I don't know how many bases we visited, but all the time we were sort of moving further and further south, because the captain, I forget who that was, quite honestly, it may have been Captain Brown, but I'm not really sure. But anyway, he had daily talks with Tom Murphy, because Tom Murphy wanted to get somewhere to stick base W on, and so did Captain Brown, if it was Captain Brown. So the closer we got to the southern end of our trip there for doing the bases, I forget which ones we got near to, but we went to Anvers Island, and I think they were starting base N there, and we unloaded a load of stuff there, went on, and always looking for the right place for W, which had to be north of base Y, because that was the slot to fill in, as it were, you know. The whole reason, it seemed to me, for our existence was to fit more bases in, because it was the International Geophysical Year, and they were, somebody somewhere was afraid of the Argentinians and the Chileans moving in more than they were. They were at various places, and so they said to themselves, right, we want a new base there, a new base there, you know, full stop, didn't care. You know, just find a place. That was the intent. I think that was what happened. And eventually, after we'd sort of been down and come back and looked around, I think Tom and the captain decided that this island, Detai Island, in the Lallemand Fjord, was about the only place that was suitable. And if it had problems, so what? You know, we can't stand and talk about that, because the winter's coming on and we've got to get out of it, said the ship.
So what was good about Detai Island? What were they specifically looking for?
It was one, well, who knows? It was a space on which we could have a base. That was about the length of it. And I could see anyway. It was in more or less the right place. And it was, you know, there was no... On the banks of the fjord and like this, and the mountainous areas going up the sides, and this was a low, rocky island, quite small, and it would be filled in by sea ice in the winter time, and therefore it could be used to set off on survey trips in different directions, and go back up the fjord and onto the, you know, up onto a plateau, which was hoped to be found, which they did find, a plateau on the top, and that was it. So, Detai Island, we'll get near it, we'll unload everything onto the scows, and backwards and forwards with the scows, unloading stores, unloading building materials, timber, concrete, fuel, food, everything.
All by hand.
All by hand. Nothing mechanical at all. Onto your shoulder and lift. And it was you couldn't even use sledges, you know, because we landed them onto a rocky area at the above the ice. There was no sea ice there. And so it was all hand manoeuvring. And at the same time as we were doing that, the builders were mixing concrete and starting to make, well, we all did, I think, at that stage, you know, we were all sort of involved in, we didn't know how to do it, but we were told what to do, you know, mix the concrete this way. And so it was very fast setting concrete, it was called fondue. It was a French concrete, had to be French, didn't it? And so we built the concrete foundations, or, you know, square lumps, as it were, all the way along. So building the foundations, and the builders carried on then when they had to set for several days, I don't know how long. And all the time we were sort of landing stores and carrying stores up to near the site of the hut. So that was another, you sort of bring it to the shore, landing it there, and then picking it up again and moving it up to the site of the hut. But that went on as a sort of a chain gang situation, you know. Meanwhile, the Biscoe had set us all ashore, but several others as well who were on movements around, you know, to different bases. And they were sort of put ashore to help us, which was fine, you know, about four or five different blokes. Good, healthy, strong young men, you know, all, you know, willing hands to move. We were very willing to do everything. We didn't stop and ask questions. We had just got on and did it all, you know. The old Biscoe came back in the end, you know, after about a week or 2 weeks, not too really sure. Even more anxious to get away now. So we loaded our friends who'd helped us, and off they went. And we all stood there on the shore, on the cliff, thinking, what the hell's going to happen now? they've gone. and we felt rather forsaken, to be perfectly honest, and, you know, rather sad that we had been dumped on the island and told to get on with it, as it were.
What state was the hut in by that point, by the time
it was left? Not in a very good state. We'd put up 3, 4, 5 tents. I don't know how many, say 3 or 4 or 5, I don't know. Some sledging tents, you know, the typical tents. You've probably seen, probably used them. And so we lived in those. We carried on doing the building. We also had built with stores, what we called the caboose, with store boxes and a canvas over the top, which we used for cooking and for general sort of meetings and cups of tea and whatever. And if we wanted a rest, we went in the caboose, and that was that. One day, Eric said, because he was in charge of the cooking, because he was a good cook. He could take a tin of stewed steak and make it into a real meal, you know. And he and Ray as well were, you know, both had experience, and they used to produce super meals for all of us gang, you know, the 14 or 15 of us originally, to, you know, some porridge for breakfast, some bacon, a bacon sandwich or something like that. And then at night, tinned a stew with stewed steak and all sorts of fairly basic foods, but good hot warming stuff. Eric said to me one day, I think you ought to have a go at cooking tomorrow. Oh, yes, okay, you know, always ready to say yes, never ready to say no. And he said, you know what to do, you know everything? I said, yeah, I'll watch you, you know. And of course, it was a disaster, an absolute disaster. I'd never done any cooking before. And it was just the wanting to do the right thing that I'd said, I can do that, you know. And I tried to make eggs and bacon for everybody on 4 primuses. Total disaster. 6 o'clock or whenever the lads finished work on the building, they all came pushing through the door and said, right, where's my dinner? And I said, it'll be another hour yet. What? And without using all the foul language that was then thrown at me, Eric said, go and sit down over there, for goodness sake, keep quiet and shut up, and I'll do the dinner. And he made something within about 20 minutes. There was a decent hot meal for everybody. Well, I took a long time to live that down, of course. But then the extras went, and it was just the 8 of us.
So John Biscoe left, and there were 8 of you left behind at Base W, and you're living in tents, but you were still continuing the building work.
Yes, it was very important to get the building finished. Before the winter really started in earnest. The weather was absolutely awful from there on, and we were living in the tents, so the idea was to work as fast as we could finishing the outside of the building, and as much of the inside as we could, so that we could move in as soon as we could, because it was getting a bit desperate outside. I remember in my tent, there was, I think, three of us, but I'm not really sure. But because we were continually using that the bed area, the bed sank by about 6 inches every night, you know, so you had to sort of fall into your sleeping bag. And then we'd say, okay, we've been here a week, we've got to move the tent because we can't climb in and out of bed anymore.
And during this time, where was all your radio equipment? Were you still in radio contact?
Nothing at all. It was all in crates. Everything was in crates. We'd put no aerials up at all. It was important to get the hut built so that we could get into it and we could start living a normal, comparatively normal life then. Until then, it was just a work site and us in the tents going to it every day and working and coming back to the tents at night after having a hot meal in the caboose, not cooked by me. So the time came when the weather was so foul that Tom said, look, we've got to move into the house now and we'll work from the outside. We'd finished the roof and we'd finished all the cladding and everything like that. We were directed by Tom and Ron and Eric as well, who took his part in, he was all there with what to do and how to do it. And eventually, as I say, it came to the day when Tom said, everybody in, let's stop living outside like natives, or something like that. And we moved into the hut. Now, the first ever time that we were in contact, I mean, we were still busy working inside. There was a lot to do, a lot of building work and painting and all sorts of things inside and getting... We'd had to get the kitchen all prepared, which was and all the water system, so that because all the water had to be just fetched in, just snow fetched in and plonked into the tanks. And so when it was habitable, then we moved in, and from there on it was a case of, well, what's the next important job? And I must say that I didn't deliberately delay my radio station, but it sort of got pushed aside somewhat because there are always other urgent things to do. There were dogs to look after, there was cooking to do inside the house, and there was all sorts of things to be done. But we did have a little domestic bush radio, which you won't remember at all, but a little domestic radio on which we could get a lot of American stations, and they played music. And then one day I was playing with it one evening. I didn't have time during the day to play with anything, but during the evening I was moving it around and suddenly loud noises coming out of it. Morse. I sat and wrote it down. And it was VPC, which is Port Stanley. And they were talking to the control base, talking to using Morse. And I just wrote down, because they said, well, all right, okay, here's some messages for you. And one was for Mike Orford, who was sitting opposite me. And I had no radio equipment, just this funny little set. And I wrote it all down, and walked over to Mike, and I said, just got a message in for you. And I won't tell you what he said, but it was foul language again. We were quite terrible like that. And I said, no, it really is a message for you. And it took a lot of convincing that it really was for him. And eventually it dawned on him that, this was from his mum, hoping everything's well. There was nothing terribly important. and he thought I was a magician of some kind, I think, that I'd produced this out of thin air, And I think the next night, Tom said, well, look, listen in every night, and then you might pick up something important, and we'll get on to you sorting out your radio room, putting up the masts and everything next week, And then came a message that said, from VPC, which was Port Stanley again, and saying, well, we've heard from base N, but we've heard nothing from base W yet. What's happening to them? And some rude reply went back from the control station. And I said to Tom, we've got to get going. We've got to get the radio set, get the transmitting station going up and get the aerials up. And so we concentrated on it. we got the radio transmitter in. It all had to be wired in, and I had lots of books which had come with the transmitters and the radio. We had two receivers, the big transmitter, an American Army one, and an old RAF one, all obviously bought surplus, you know, surplus stock after the war. And so everything was done. We put up the aerials, and I thought, God, these aerials aren't going to last very long. Absolutely fragile, silly little things they were.
So they were just buried into the ground, were they? Or how did you...
Well, we had to fix the masts into cement in the ground, in the rocks outside, because there was still rock available to use, and they had four guy ropes, or guy wires actually they were, so we had to get the secure fitting for those. So I worked out, and I'd got this not from any knowledge but from a book, that I had to get them and point the aerial pointing in a certain direction. So we did that, and got everything stringed up, and so I sat there one night. I'd done a little test on it and worked up. It was a transmitter which you had to work on hard to get it going, you know, twiddle that and twiddle that and twiddle that and twiddle that, and then press that button, and then it should be going well. And after a little while I got the hang of it. And I sat there one afternoon and listened to the sked that was going on the receivers. I thought, oh, well, I'll wait till the end of the sked, and then I'll tune in with Z32, which was my call sign, or ZHF32, but, you know, you just cut things down to Z32. And so I did a general call, which was CQ from Z32, you know, come in if anybody can hear me. No answer. They all thought, well, I didn't think anybody heard it at all, you know. I thought, you know, this is all going to be downhill, you know, from here.
Do you think it was that you'd set up the aerials wrong, that the transmitter wasn't working?
I did not know. I mean, I could see that the transmitter was working. You know, whenever I hit the key, it was going like this, and something was working right, you know. And I thought, right, I'll have another go later on in the day. So it was evening then, after the evening sked. And I think it was a bit later than that. And I think I'd heard them say, you know, we're still all listening for base W, you know, they're all listening, but they weren't, perhaps I was in the wrong frequency. Anyway, they told me the frequencies, and that was the only bit of information that I ever got from Lofty at Fort Stanley. And that gave me the frequencies for the base and the control. And so...
Okay, so this is a sheet of paper that lists all the different radio codes for the call signs for the different bases.
That's right.
So you've got Port Lockroy, Anvers, Argentine, and then down here, base and control. So control was Port Stanley.
Control actually was the controlling base, which was Port Lockroy, and so that was the one I had to work with. But I listened to Port Stanley because they came through loud and strong. They had much stronger transmitters than we did. But anyway, that evening, I think it was, I sent out another general call. And I think it was somebody way in the distance said, I can hear you loud and strong, you know, in Morse. Can you hear me? And it wasn't very... It wasn't loud and strong, but anyway, I could read him, and so we made contact. Yeah, oh, thank God for that.
So we're up and running. How long was that you'd been out of contact with the world?
This was during May. I've got the date somewhere, but it was during May, possibly about halfway through May. So it was long enough. You know, everybody probably thought, well, they're all dead, you know. No, pick them up next year.
So was there a bit of triumph with that? How did that feel to be back in contact? Was it relief?
It was triumph and relief, because I had been concerned the whole time, from the time they first said, you are going to start a new radio station at the new base W. I thought to myself, is this ever really going to happen? I can't see it. I haven't really got the experience. And having accepted the job to do that, and there was no way out, in other words, I had to go and do it and make a success of it. And this was my first success. So that was grand. So we were getting used to life we were getting used to life as a base. We all worked together, doing all the usual things, you know, all the basic chores and so on. I joined the three skeds that were essential every day to send weather information and all the traffic that I had to send that was official, and received the vast amount of stuff that had been piling up with the control station. And we spent several hours that first 3 or 4 days with him passing me loads and loads of messages. My arm got tired writing, you know. And it was Peter Bunch at Lockroy, and he was a bit of a, I've never seen him since, but he was an ex-Navy, and he was a bit rough and tough, you know. And he asked me one day, was I taking the mickey out of him? Because I'd missed something, you know. And you, in the Navy, you didn't miss things, obviously. I did, because I'd been in the Air Force, was his attitude. And so I'd asked him to go back, and that was when he got a bit fruity with me. But we made friends in Morse afterwards, and that was the way it carried on. So having said that, I could not reach Port Stanley with my equipment, no matter how I tried, because the transmitter was not capable of being wound up to its true potential.
So Port Lockroy collected all the messages and then forwarded that on to Port Stanley?
That's right, for me. I think that was only for me, because I was having that difficulty getting through to Port Stanley. Whether that was the situation we were in the fjord, whether it was my aerials pointed slightly in the wrong direction, whether it was my transmitter, I never found out, to be perfectly honest. And I soon after, you know, well on, sorry, I'll start again. At a certain stage, I had to make a report to Tom to say, we've got to have new aerials next year. It's just got to be done. Because once the weather got really bad, the aerial masts and the aerial wire iced up so heavily that it just broke the masts, just like that. And there was no way, I think some of the masts on some of the bases were strong enough to have a bosun's chair going up them, so somebody could go up, you know, be pulled up and clear the aerials. There was no way that you could do that with these fragile little masts that were useless. So after about the third collapse, which became a running joke in the base, you know, David, your masts are down again. And everybody ran then to do something about it. And Ron Miller built wooden ones for me, using what he could of the metal, but he built wooden. I've not been able to find any. That's Ray. If you stayed on the right side of Ray, I'll tell you something about him in a minute. But it's really very funny. But made us laugh anyway. I think that was summertime.
So when these masts collapsed, did that mean that there was no...
No contact. You just stayed silent. You know, you couldn't do anything. You couldn't send anything. They had to be up, and the aerial up and in good form before you could send any messages.
So how were you repairing them? Just putting them back in the ground in a stronger position?
Exactly, yes. Or? Yes, exactly that. You know, they had to be repaired and put up again and hope for the best. And then in the end, as I say, Ron Miller constructed two wooden masts, which were much, much more substantial, and the aerial of course had to come down, and that again was sort of knocking my signal down all the time, because it just wasn't strong enough to, I mean, Port Lockroy could read me easily, but there's no way it could get through to Port Stanley. So anyway, that's the way we arranged to have it. I could read everybody quite happily on the receivers. I could read everybody without any problem at all, except the ones who couldn't send Morse. No names, no patrol.
So what sort of messages were being sent? Were these messages from home as well as operational messages?
Incoming messages from home, the monthly letters from your truly beloveds and mums and all that sort of stuff. And going out, it was just weather reports, which the meteorologists were taking weather record, you know, weather readings every day, and they would convert that into a number code, and I had to send that off to, Yes, I used to send them to Port Lockroy as well. And so that was the traffic. And anything that Tom had to say to headquarters had to be, you know, written out and probably in code. I think it used to be in code. I'm not really sure about that. So all into 5-number codes. And somewhere, anyway, anything that was regarded as very important was coded, and otherwise it was in plain language. So that was
that. What limitations were there on the messages that you get from home? Was it just that you were allowed your one monthly letter, or did you have someone that would write 4-page letters to their beloved son and someone else that would write just a sentence, or could it be whatever you wanted?
I just remember it was very limited. I mean, I've got some of them here, which I've collected up from the past, but any monthly letter seems to be about that long at the most.
About a paragraph.
And then I had cables coming in, which were not limited, because they could go down to the post office and send off a cable to me. And, you know, and my mum used to say to go into the post office and say, this is to base W, so-and-so. And they used to sit there like that, you know, saying, oh, gosh, there's a special lady come in. But she used to enjoy that. So that's what it was. So lots of, and of course we could read everybody else's, I could anyway, read everybody else's special messages is coming in, and some quite hilarious from girlfriends, wives-to-be, and so on and so forth, you know, but I never passed them round. I just used to have a quiet chuckle for myself. I shouldn't really be saying this, should I?
It must have been a position of trust within that party of eight, because you were privy to all the sort of messages that were coming
absolutely,
in.
Absolutely, yes. Oh, yes. I didn't play about with it, really and truly. It came to me, I sent it, and that was the end of it. You know, I would tear up the bit of paper that I had. And no, hang on, I used to keep them. Yes, I was supposed to keep them in a file. I think Lofty told me I had to keep every message that I sent. But since I was a little bit put out, because one of the things they failed to do was enclose any message pads at all. And so I had to steal paper from the meteorological department to write my messages, which was typical. You know, I felt it was this all tied in with my views that it was all put together in a bit of a hurry. A, they didn't know where to put us. B, some of the equipment didn't ever get through or came in the wrong size parcels or whatever.
So Base W was put together in a bit of a hurry.
I believe that is my personal opinion. Yes, it would have been a nasty job for somebody to do. You know, so in logistics somewhere, somebody had to put it all together. And I'm not blaming them, because they did a pretty good job, but there were weak areas, let's put it like that. Talking about Ray, we'd been in the hut for some time, and Ray said, we've got a gramophone. This is an old-fashioned gramophone, of course, but we've got no needles. Now, that'll tell you the age. So we were all sitting there one night, and Ray said, I love South Pacific, and I want to hear it now. So we all thought you old softy, but we didn't say it, not to Ray. So Ray and I said, we'll go out, and of course it was snowing like a storm out there, and we found out which box the needles were supposed to be in, because there were still stores to unload and to break out and to bring into the hut, you know. So we searched for about 2 hours in this snowstorm, and eventually found the right box. We had to chip ice off the boxes to get the right numbers, and several numbers that it should have been in, the needles weren't there. And eventually we got the needles, brought them in triumph, and started, and we found the records, and played South Pacific. And Ray sat there with great enjoyment and enjoyed it, and we all enjoyed it. But after the fourth or fifth time of hearing South Pacific, we all got a bit fed up with it. But there we are, we suffered.
Did you ever hear any radio traffic from other nationalities down there? You mentioned there were sort of Argentinian and Chilean bases along the peninsula. Did you ever?
I never bothered to go looking for work. That, I think, is the long and the short of it. You know, I used to listen sometimes to ships working, and that was always interesting, you know, if they were sending peculiar messages. about you know, the whaling ships and so on were still operating then, not many of them, but that was always interesting to listen to, because Grytviken had had a radio station there. It wasn't FIDS, or it wasn't anything to do with BAS or anything like that. It was the whalers. I think it was part of the Falkland Islands dependency. So it was, but somebody I didn't know. When I was on the way back, I heard that they wanted another operator, because the one was going home, or was going to go home shortly. And I thought, oh, what a great idea. We'll get married, you know, because I'd left almost under a cloud, because I said I didn't even want to get engaged before I went south. And we'd get married when I got back, you know. And I thought, what a great idea. I'll come back, get married, and then we'll both go to South Georgia. And Charlotte sent back a very rude message to say, I am not thinking in terms of going to South Georgia. If you go there, you're on your own.
The interview were very much, it seems like, on your own at Base W, and you had a lot of work to be doing during the winter, but how were you feeling? Did you feel a little bit like you'd been abandoned on this tiny island?
Or? No. I mean, that feeling wore off. You had a busy life to lead, even though you can't think what we could have done all day, but there was a lot to do. Feeding the dogs, going out catching, shooting seals when they were around, and going out catching penguins. I hope you're not an animal lover, but we used to go out on penguin hunts. I used to hate it, and I said to Tom, I don't want to do this. And he said, you probably won't got to. It's our food, and the dog's food as well. He said, get yourself a big stick and come along. Don't be such a pansy.
And did you have a favourite penguin meal?
Yes.
Preparation of penguin? What's the best?
Absolutely, and that was to fry it in butter. We had loads and loads of butter, and we used that for all the cooking. So we used to cut the penguin up into small pieces and fry it, and that was beautiful, like steak, just like steak. You probably had that many a time from many a fed, but it really was. It is lovely food, especially when it's the only fresh food you've had that week, you know, because we used to do it on the Saturday night always. That was the last meal of the cook's week, and then on the Saturday night, and used to do a big fry up of penguin. I didn't like doing the butchering, and I sometimes used to con Ron Miller into doing that, because he knew how to do it. And so he used to skin the penguins, and I used to do the butchering after that, cut up the breasts. That was all you could use. You couldn't use the legs. But it made a good meal. So sometimes we'd have seal, what's it called? You know, the livers and that sort of thing, you know, the offal. I didn't really care for that very much. And I know Headley once produced slabs of seal which he'd roasted for Sunday lunch, and I thought that was awful. But anyway, you know, you didn't grumble too much about these things. You did sometimes, but we used to make bread every day, I used to love making bread, and I really enjoyed it, and I used to really put everything into it, you know, and making apple pies as well. That was another speciality of mine. You know, tinned apples, obviously, and but we had lots of flour to use, and so some people weren't all that good at making bread, and we used to sit and chew on it in the silence, you know, without being too cross about it. And we did expect to have biscuits at coffee time and cakes at tea time, and if we didn't get those, we were a bit morose, you know, with the cook, because it was expected, you know, it was expected of you to do that, produce it. You got time, and I had, I suppose, a difficult job in that I had to keep breaking off and going and doing skeds three times a day. But the others had other jobs to do as well. But it was a busy time, and we worked well as a team. You know, we the only bit of annoyance that we had was on midwinter's night, which was June the 21st, and there was a bit more beer going and whiskey going than any time. And I must say that when I went to bed, everything was quiet. But the next morning, somebody who shall not be named had a black eye. And nobody said anything about it. It was just oh, well, you know, he's got a black eye, is he?
Maybe they couldn't remember.
Possibly. Well, I think they did, but it was all kept. We just kept it quiet between us, you know. It was like a family. We didn't want to talk about it. Not like EastEnders. We'd all be talking about it. so that was that. But Ray had another thing to cheer us all up, because he'd done his time in the Navy. And if we were a bit down, he used to get out his paybook. I think I called it a paybook or something of that nature. It showed his record in the Navy. And he started off as an ordinary seaman, I think, or worked his way up to able seaman, and then became a petty officer, which he should do. He was one of the leaders of men, you know. Then came wording, struck officer, demoted to ordinary seaman. So that was Ray. He worked his way all up to petty officer three times in his service. Three times. Every time he struck an officer when things got bad. And he was demoted down the hill again. So that used to make us roar with laughter, so the way he told us all about that and what these officers had said to him and what the other. And he said, I had to hit him in the end. I just had to hit him. And that was that.
So you had dogs at Base W. Was yes. it just one dog team?
I can't remember how many dogs we had, to be truthful, but it was about 20. And that made two teams. To the best of my knowledge, I was not a sledging man at all. I didn't go out with, you know, sledging at all. I asked Tom to let me go sledging, and he said, no, I've been told, David, that you are not to go sledging.
Exactly.
Why? Yes, why, I said. He said, well, they've told me, I shouldn't tell you this, he said, but you've got medical, a minor medical problem, and it may be only minor, but I don't want to run the risk of you running about 100 miles away with dogs and, you know, for you to break down. As it happened, the only time that it did get me, and I was really perfectly healthy all the way through, except when Headley and, you know, by this time we'd gone through the winter and sledging parties were going out. Tom went, Tom and Eric and Mike and Headley and John Thorne were all going sledging regularly. I think that covers all of us. I have a job to remember who they were now. Anyway, never mind. Headley and John had gone out surveying down towards the south on sea ice. Perfectly, you know, we got loads of sea ice all around us by then. That was great. The weather was still pretty bad, but it wasn't too bad after the winter period had finished in sort of October, something like sort of September, October. But off they went, and I had terrible difficulty with getting the sledging sets, the sledging radio sets, to get work properly, and I couldn't do it. So they went off without really having confirmation that they would be able to call me on my main set, and it was a weakness which I regretted, but that was the situation. I couldn't wave a magic wand over them. I couldn't get them going properly. It might have been batteries, it might have been anything. Anyway, so all the sea ice went out one morning when they were supposed to be on the way back. The whole fjord cleared, and it was a mill, you know, like it was water. And we knew that they'd be coming back there, and we suddenly saw one day their tent on Roux Island, R-O-U-X Island, which is about 10 miles across the fjord from where we were. I don't know how many miles, but about 10, I think.
So until then, had you been really worried about them, that they were, because they couldn't contact you to say they were all right?
We were, yes. At the last stages, when the sea ice went out, we were worried, because we thought, how the hell, you know. We knew there was no other way back round if they went along the coast into the fjord, because they couldn't travel it. However, we didn't really know what to do, so we just waited to see if we could see them, which we did eventually. After about 2 days, and we'd made some sort of contact, you know, with lights, with all this lamp and so on and so forth, but not very good progress. And Tom said, well, we've got to make some effort to go and get them. So he said to Ron and myself, you know, we've got the small dinghy, we've got an outboard motor. It was a very small boat, and with an outboard motor, and he'd packed up a parcel of goodies for them to have, you know, cigarettes and more cigarettes and biscuits and sweets and so on. And he said, bring back, you know, two dogs, and we'll do it in relays like that. Two dogs, or, you know, however many you can get on board, and eventually we'll bring back Headley and John. Ron and I set off, and it was calm as a mill pond going over. No trouble at all. And we landed, had a quick chat, put two dogs on board. One was Steve and one was Porgy, I think, as it was. And we set off back across the bay to Base W. Well, after a period of time, we knew that the wind was getting up from the north. We knew it was getting up, and the wind, as you will know, can get up very, very quickly down there. And no messing about, suddenly we were in heavy weather. And we had two dogs. Ron was on the tiller. I was looking after the dogs and keeping them calm, because they weren't terribly pleased with it, the dogs, especially, you know, the lump. We were lumping about all over the place. And then the outboard cut out. The dogs seemed to panic even more at that stage. And Ron was busy fiddling about with the engine at the back. It was no good me doing it. I should have made the engine worse. But he was capable of getting it going if it was capable of being got ready again. Anyway, we were starting to ship water quite heavily then. The dogs were going berserk, and I feared that they would jump over and drag us down with it, or make life really impossible, A, for themselves, and B, for us, because they probably tipped the boat over. So I got back, Ron said, we've got to bail out, we've got to get rid of some of this water, and I managed to get back past the dogs, away from them, and we bailed out, and then he said, I'm going to try that motor again. I don't know if we even spoke very much at that time, you know, because we were both scared as hell, because we thought we were going down. Anyway, we bailed out sufficiently to make it livable again, and he had another go at the engine, and sure enough, it fired. And so there's no point in this weather trying to get back to base, which was a long way away as far as we were concerned. So we said, OK, back to where Headley and John are. And this we did, and it was, you know, a reasonably acceptable journey back to them. Whereas it would have been dead if we'd tried to carry on back to base, it would definitely, because we knew perfectly well that the ice would be coming roaring back in pretty damn quick, because that's the way it had gone. And with this wind, it was coming, bringing it back in. And sure enough, the next day it was all there, you know, and we'd have been chopped up by that, if nothing else. We got back to Rue Island, and there was John and Headley. And Headley, what do you think you're doing coming back here? I haven't got enough rations for you. we paid no attention to it. We just said, we're here, we're staying. You know, we'll stay overnight. And we put the dogs ashore and tied them up and so on. And John, who was a much more sensible character, said, right, we'll get this tent for you and this, that and the other. So we put up the other tent and we'll make the rations work. Don't you worry about Headley. And and that was it. But the ice had come in. It was all in great big chunks all over the place, and there was no way anybody was going to get back with the dogs or with the boat. And so after about a week of living like this and in rather bad conditions, and at that stage, whether it was the worry of it all or what, but I don't know, or whether it might have been Ron Miller smoking cigarettes in the tent, and I suspect it was him, but I would never say anything to him about that, because they were very cheap cigarettes he used to smoke. And I was coughing and puffing and in a bit of a bad state and not very much good to anybody at that point. And I thought, well, I think he probably got fed up with me coughing, and Headley was fed up with everybody and everything. And I think they talked together and thought, right, we're going to go back, we'll ski over this rough ice, or walk back over this rough ice, And I didn't know anything about it until they'd gone. And John came from his tent and said to me, they've gone. And I thought, well, that's the end of them. You know, they're never going to get there. But they did. And we had a message flashed back. Eric used the lamp to tell us that they were back safe. And I think we told him, there's no way we're going to do it. No way we're going to do it. It would have been silly. All the dogs were there anyway, so they had to be looked after.
And what about the food? So the rations were tight already, so you'd been there a week with four of you.
I think John and Ron killed a seal in that first week. I don't think there were any penguins around there, but there was enough to scrape and, you know, and cut down the rations a bit. And I don't really remember how we got through. And I didn't do any cooking over there. It was all down to John when we were two by ourselves. I think he felt better with that. Although he wasn't such a brilliant cook. But it was all pemmican. And we just cut down on the pemmican. We weren't doing much heavy work, no heavy work at all. So we just had fairly limited rations and enjoyed what we had, and that was that. And eventually, we had a message from base, which it was difficult to pick up, but it was a light done by Eric. And we also heard, by that time, I'd managed to be hearing base Y, and we heard Jean Donnelly saying that there was going to be a helicopter brought in. He wasn't speaking directly to us, he was talking to one of the other bases. So that's what happened. We were told, we were informed by LAMP from Base W that a helicopter would be above us at some time the next day. So have the dogs ready or whatever, and so we prepared everything. And sure enough, a helicopter came, out of complete magic as far as we were concerned. What had happened was that the Protector, HMS Protector, with their two helicopters, had come down much further south than they'd ever come before, because they didn't like ice at all, quite naturally. I'll tell you something else funny about the Protector as well, but anyway, there was this helicopter, and we got one dog and put him up into the, we harnessed him up, and John and I lifted him, and up he went. And John said, I'm going to go back to base. I don't know why he said that, but anyway, he did. He said, you look after the dogs. And I said, okay, fair enough, send him back and I'll load up the dogs. And off he went. I think he'd had enough. And he'd been there that bit longer, and I think he was fed up with the whole damn thing. And so he went back to base, and the helicopter came back. And there was nobody in it to help me, so I had to go and get two dogs, or one dog, and untie him, bring him up. And of course, the whirring helicopter above, the dog was going like this, and didn't want to get into the harness at all. But after a struggle, and I managed to sort of lift him off his feet to get him on the harness, which was sort of hanging about there. How I did it, I don't know. I couldn't do it now. And that dog went up. And of course, we had a two-way radio between the helicopter. They'd thrown down a two-way radio, which was handy. And they said, we don't want any more, said the man at the back, not the pilot. He had enough job keeping it steady. And I said, well, surely we could take one more. I seem to remember this conversation. Oh, all right, he said, okay. What if they fight, though? I said, they won't fight. Of course, dogs are fearful for fighting. And I thought, never mind. We'll find out when we get there. So I brought another dog up. We got him in, and he said, right, that's it. I'm not having any more dogs. You better come up, and I'll take you back, and I'll bring somebody else out. So I got up there. The dogs were sitting there like this. They weren't going to fight. They knew they were up against it there. They just kept quiet and shut up and get on with it. And so we went back, and I don't remember anything of the journey at all. I've got pictures of it hovering around us somewhere. Which I can show you perhaps before you go. And I jumped out, and I think they were worried about landing. So I said, well, bring it down so that I can jump. And I remembered, and they in their report said, the scientist jumped out from 5 feet up. And we told him not to, but he did.
What about the dogs?
The dogs,
the more or less sort of, they didn't want to handle them too much, so they were sort of thrown out, caught the dogs, put them down, and they were led off and put on their line, you know, on their usual line. And Tom said, go on, he said, go inside, there's a whiskey waiting for you. And I said, oh, that's what I need, just what I need. I was exhausted by that time. And, you know, with not much food for the last month and carrying dogs around. And so that was the end of it, really. They did two or three more journeys with two or three blokes, and they brought all the dogs back and some of the equipment and Headley and well, so that was the end of the adventure.
I take it the helicopter pilot didn't think much of having dogs in the back. You tell me a story about, he wasn't impressed with the smell.
In the end, I don't know if I can find that report quickly, but basically, terrible, isn't it? Let's hear it be here. It was agreed to lift by winch one survivor as a handler and one dog in the first instance. That was John and his dog going back. And then, however, it showed we have to lift more than one dog per. Yes. We did not want, this is the pilot talking, we did not want to have a dog riot in the rear cabin. Mike, that was sit or stay, you know, or a dog owner from youth, wasn't sure that Huskies would understand or respond to sit or stay. Ridiculous. But anyway. Yes, but the two pilots, Mike Harvey and Mike Rawlinson, both recalled that the rescue was a fascinating, challenging and memorable experience. It was for me too. Those rescued seemed very thankful, although it was difficult to share feelings either way at the time. It was. But they were well remembered, if only for the strong distinctive smell from the dogs, and maybe the surveyors too, who had survived remarkably well without the home comforts of a Fidd's base, home comforts in inverted commas, of a Fidd's base for a very long time. So that was that bit.
So what's that report you're reading from there? That was the base report,
wasn't it? That was essentially, that's some from John's diary of that trip. But the report I was reading from there was, excuse me, that particular report was from the HMS Protector, the Rue Island Rescue, they call it. So it's an account of a rescue carried out south of the Antarctic Circle by Royal Navy helicopters of the Fleet Air Arm.
So you were going to tell me another story about the Protector you mentioned.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, after we'd been relieved and we were on the new John Biscoe, I think, by then, and we went down towards Alexandra Land, which was even further south. The weather was pretty awful, and I think HMS Protector came down for some reason, knowing that they were safe because it was either Bransfield or the new John Biscoe. They'd sold the old John Biscoe by then. Anyway, it was felt that I don't know by whom, I think we felt all a bit nervous with HMS Protector prowling about for some reason, and one of the seamen, who was a rather funny lad, went to the refrigerator and got loads of cubes of ice and threw them in the water and said, "There, Protector, it's ice, just be careful, off you go." And shortly after that they left the scene. Which was all a bit silly, we all had a huge laugh about it. And there was no reason for it at all, but just for a laugh.
So that was a rather dramatic end to your winter at
BASEW.
I mean, were there any other sort of scary periods that you remember from?
Nothing really. I mean, it was scary enough doing the ordinary Antarctic things. In other words, disposing of waste every day, you know, kitchen waste and whatever. And we had to go, either one of us or two of us, to carry it to the ice cliff and tip it over. You know, nothing like today when I think it's all, everything's cleaned up, isn't it? But this was, oh well, somebody else will have to come and clean this off, woof, you know. But on a heavy day, when the wind was really, you know, taking you down to knee level, as it were, that was frightening enough, going doing just an ordinary little job like that. but nothing very. I mean, you got used to it and knew how to knew how to crawl along and do the business. But the only other, I suppose the only other thing that was out of the ordinary was we had the Royal Prince Philip was doing his tour of the world on Britannia, and he got near to the, there he is there, he got to Port Stanley and he said, I rather fancy seeing one or two of the bases. So we got to hear about that and we said, oh, thank God we're too far south for that, you know. And he started off at Cygnia, I think, and went to Hope Bay or Deception. And then he said, I want to go further south. And everybody had to do what Prince Philip said. So I had a message, I think, late one night saying, expect arrival of HRH Duke of Edinburgh tomorrow at about midday. Oh, well, you can imagine what we said. So we were up all night, scrubbing, cleaning, doing everything, you know, make it look like Buckingham Palace as near as we possibly could. And sure enough, the ships, he transferred to either the New Biscay or something, one of the ships, I can't remember. And sure enough, then they came ashore, a great big body of men, the Duke amongst them and several other naval officers and several bodies from Port Stanley and from FIDS. They all came ashore and I've got some photographs of them somewhere, not very good ones. But anyway, and so he proceeded to inspect the base. And he was a jolly man and very nice and pleasant, and he walked all around and he came to see me. I was in the radio room. I think this was about 2 o'clock by then, and I was just about to start a sked. And anyway, I can't remember whether I actually did or not. It may have been just before that or just after it. He asked me, he was there for about half an hour or so, asking me all sorts of questions, which I wouldn't have thought that he would have asked. But anyway, he did, and he was very knowledgeable. And so we chatted backwards and forwards for a good long time. It may have been 20 minutes. It may, you know, you're not counting time on those things. He said, well, thanks very much indeed. OK, I'll go and look at the Met Room now. And that was that. So I'd had a good long chat with him and he'd learned a bit about it. And then they went off up to a great body of them went up to the penguin rookery to see the penguins. Then they came back and I heard all this laughter outside my window right immediately. I was like, well, okay, I'll go and look and see what's going on. And there they were holding the tennis match, the famous tennis match. And so I said, well, Tom, what's going on? He said, they've said that this is the first Antarctic tennis tournament. And they were all half drunk, to be perfectly honest. And they were bashing the ball about and falling over and laughing. And it was just a great joke and a jape to them, you know. And we stood and watched them. We all laughed and clapped, and that was the tennis. And it was done fairly quickly, I can tell you that, because they were a bit cold and they wanted another drink.
So is that the Duke's idea?
I believe it was the Duke that said, we've got, now that we're here, he said, you've brought the tennis rackets, let's have a game, you know. And I didn't hear that, but this is what Tom said, because he was with them all the time. And so that was it, and it's been talked of ever since. And I think other bases have said that they had the first tennis match, but they never did. We had base W. So anyway, they all cleared off in the end and went back to the ship before going back to Protector, and then back to the Britannia, which was much further north. They didn't want that touched by ice, obviously. So that was that.
You mentioned earlier that you had a bit of fun about the Protector. I mean, how was she regarded by the rest of you that was down there? Did they not come far south enough to?
No, they you know, we regarded them as a sort of observing from a distance, as it were. You know, we knew that. I think at some in the northern bases, where there wasn't a lot of sea ice around or any bergy bits or anything like that to bump into them, I've got a good picture of where a berg bumped into the John Biscoe and bent all its back end in. We had really no opinion of them as such, you know, except that they were sort of You know, for us they were very necessary because they did a good job, which we would have been in serious trouble if they hadn't been able to send their helicopters in. But they must, knowing some naval men and having known a little bit about the Navy, there must have been some very worried frowns back on the Protector while their nice two helicopters were out sorting us lot out. Why didn't we look after ourselves a bit better? Must have been the sort of attitude. But, you know, nothing other than that.